Hello there. Welcome to Cool Climate Living. I'm Susan Lacey. Well, going to the movies has always been a popular pastime, ever since talking pictures were first invented. We've been through silent black and white movies, the excitement of Technicolor, and the huge changes to images possible because of digital film. And going to the movies has always been an important social event for many of us. Today, we'll visit a couple of local cinemas set up in the 1930s and 1940s, back in the time where it seems like every town had a picture theatre. And we're also going to hear from one of our own 2MC presenters, a well-known movie buff, who will explore some of these early movies. Now I'd like to introduce Lucy East to the program. Lucy is a co-owner of the Malachi Gilmore Hall in Oberon. This has a wonderful history in the Oberon community, including cinema, and I look forward to hearing from Lucy about what that history has been. But Lucy has also set up an artist-run initiative called Oberon Live Projects, and this is going to become immensely important when it gets to actually completing the rehabilitation of the Malachi Gilmore Hall. Lucy, it's terrific to have you join me today. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Susan. It's just lovely to be here. Thanks for showing some interest in this amazing building. Yeah, the Malachi, it stops everybody in the street, really. You can't walk past it. It looks like it's landed from space, even in 2019. But it was built in 1937 by the Catholic Church. And it was quite visionary in it, mostly Art Deco style, but it's actually a specific part of Art Deco. It's called the interwar modernist style. So it's got a little hint of Frank Lloyd Wright or some Italian modernist architecture. Quite unique in New South Wales, actually.
Yes, it certainly looks outstanding.
It was originally all concrete, one colour, the facade, and in the 80s it was painted the lovely sunset colours it is now, and we'll be moving it on to a different facade painting in this next year as we refurbish the building that everybody loves so much.
Now, it's been going, as you say, since 1937, and there's a whole range of community activities took place in that building, didn't they?
Yes. So the Catholic Church commissioned it to be a community hall with a cinema capability. And from 1937 right up to 1977, so 40 years, everything that was happening in Oberon was happening in the Malachi Gilmore Hall. They had the film screenings, they had the dances and the balls, they had civic receptions, they had roller skating and art exhibitions. It was truly a, you know, multi-use purpose building right from its inception.
What can you tell me about the film screenings?
Well, the lovely connection with me and the Malachi is that my great-uncle, Les Antis, was the first cinema projectionist in the Malachi. And so he started in 1937 under the watchful eyes of the Catholic nuns with what he was programming. And so he would show films on the massive projectors, fire hazards, sort of carbon arc screens and things. Things will be much easier for me. We're going digital, which is a saving grace, really. My great uncle Les also brought electricity to Oberon, so he set up a generator in his front yard and, yes, sent the electricity all the way across the high street over to the Malachi Gilmore Hall.
Good heavens. Tell me what kinds of films were being shown then.
Well, they were really showing, you know, the latest and greatest. It's extraordinary to hear a lot about how the films were sent around by horses and carriages and trains. And the projectionist that also then took on from my uncle was Herb David, and I've been talking to his three daughters, who were very involved right up till his death in 1977, showing all the films. And they would talk of, you know, having to rewind the films and check that they hadn't broken any little bits and editing out sections that were ripped before they sent the film on to the next cinema to show it. I know that Herb David was a great advocate for Australian films, so he would make sure that he would show anything that was Australian made.
Do you remember any of the film titles?
Oh, I have a whole list of them. I do know that when I have spoken to locals, they remember Gone with the Wind being shown many times.
Oh, yes.
And they all remember The Sound of Music. So, you know, films that we still all love now, and I'm really looking forward to being able to show again, especially as that audience, you know, they're still around in Oberon, and the building is just so cherished in their childhood memories. Last October, we had a community heritage project we put on called the Malachi Revival. Mm. And for a whole weekend, we basically filled it with people again. We had six events, from dancing to a big swing dance party, and we showed a couple of movies on the Sunday evening. And, the hall was full again, and it was just an absolute joy. Promise of things to come.
I actually went myself to have a look around, and I noticed just on the left-hand side as you walked in the entrance, there was a huge piece of cinema equipment. What was that?
So it was a Westrex 35mm projector, and we have two of them. They're not the original ones from the Malachi, but they were almost identical. One of the locals used to help as a child, and he had a good look over them and helped clean them. So we've put them there as a small display just to show what equipment was originally used.
At what time did the film screenings start? Do you know?
Right from the beginning of the building.
Oh, okay. Yes. So they would have been started with the old black and white silent movies, perhaps?
I know that there were sound capabilities right from the beginning.
Right.
Up in the projection room, the holes that show the projection light, but also for the audio. So they had record players up there.
Nice.
And so we also have a lot of the original advertising, the glass slides that were shown in A Magic Lantern, and also the audio recording that was made. Actually, here in Sydney, they would record the week's worth of ads and, yes, send the vinyl up, and they'd play it on a little record player and feed it through to the audience.
Well, it'll be fascinating to see those again.
Yes, we have a few of the slides and some of the recordings.
Lucy, in terms of helping you to work out your plans for the future of the Malachi Gilmore Hall, what kind of research have you done to figure out what's going to work best?
Well, we're really fortunate. There was a group of friends that became the Friends of the Malachi. And when the building in 1977 stood almost derelict, they started collecting the information. So they've got lists of all of the events that used to happen there, lists of the films. They also had a lot of the original documentation of the actual building of the building. Mm. So it's just a great archive, being able to source lots of ideas. And the pleasure I get is looking at the events that used to happen there and reinventing it for a future audience. It's a really creative and hopefully an imaginative approach that should really make a nice bridge from what used to happen to what needs to happen now. So whatever we program at the Malachi is really relevant and interesting to the community.
Have you had a chance to look at other regional locations and what their histories were with respect to cinema?
Yes, you know, I'm trying to find as much information as I can from people who've already walked this path. So my husband and I went on a road trip just after Christmas, and we headed down all the way through southern New South Wales, down to Victoria, and saw other communities. One that just springs to mind is a town just above Melbourne called Swanpool that has 680 residents, and 80 of them all volunteer at the local cinema, which is just a hall with a projector, and everyone gets involved. It's a real community focus. But we had lots of fun, and everyone was incredibly supportive and helpful, giving me lots of good advice, mostly about, can you actually run a cinema without popcorn? A complete nightmare to clean up.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I can.
Oh, yes. Well, people will bring all kinds of things to the cinema now, I guess.
Yes.
Do you know if there are very many old cinemas still operating?
I think it's a really limited amount in New South Wales. In its heyday, which was the 40s and the 50s, there was one in every town, really. You know, if they didn't have a purpose-built cinema, they used the School of the Arts Hall, or it was such an important thing. And then in the 70s, with, you know, the advent of television, it all seemed to drop off. It's a real renaissance, though, to go to the cinema again. But I don't know the actual number, but it's less than 100. Our building is state heritage listed, so it's very much protected. And we have a lot of, not restrictions, but we really have to bring back its heritage use. It's very important to the Heritage Council that its social heritage is retained.
Oh, well, I think that's one of the reasons why there's so much interest in what's happening at the Malachi Gilmore.
Yes, I'm feeling the weight of the responsibility. We've also got a lot of red tape wrapped around our ankles, so
yes.
The journey is going reasonably slowly, and I know that people are waited with bated breath. It's coming. This year we'll see definitely some art exhibitions.
Let's talk about your plans for the future then. First of all, let me ask the question, what is your philosophy of the kinds of activities that will take place in the hall?
That's a fantastic question. So we really want to establish a place where there's creativity and crafting and conversation. And really that can happen around a movie. We're hoping to start some film societies, a kids film society, a young adult film society, and an adult, probably art house film society, as well as showing just single films. So that is, you know, a chance for people to come and regularly go to the movies with the same people and have a chance to have a good, you know, natter about it. I'm a musician, so to be able to put on concerts there, and it's got wonderful acoustics, is really something that's very dear to me. And then I've also been doing some installation art in the last couple of years, and so being able to put on some art exhibitions in that space. It's a really lovely space. The front of the building is extraordinary, but the hall is reasonably modest. But that actually lends well to lots of other creative things filling it.
That's right. Now, I know that for a very long time, the front part of the building was the local craft centre.
Yes,
called the Cobweb, and the back part of the building was used to store a lot of bales of wool.
That's right.
I was surprised when I came during your opening that that smell of lanolin was faint but not overwhelming.
When we first went to view the building, we were so happy to see that Cobweb was in there. It was, you know, open 7 days a week. So the community has continually been able to go into the front of the building. The rear of the building, yes, was a wool handler's warehouse, and the bales of wool were stacked high. It was extraordinary to walk in there, and a lot of machinery. The floor in there is a Jarrah floor, and so many people say, oh, did the lanolin really preserve it? It didn't necessarily preserve it, but it certainly kept the building intact. And so for that, we're really grateful. We just needed to knock the wall out between the foyer and the hall. And yes, off we go.
Must have taken a real lot of work to get that cleaned up, I can imagine.
That's true. Thanks for noticing.
All right. Well, can we talk a little bit about a time scale? I know that you've got plans in at council, and you talked earlier about having your ankles wrapped with red tape. You know, how long is that preparatory work likely to take, do you think?
So we've owned the building for a year now, and I feel like we've got quite a lot done. We've had our development application approved. It's just got a few conditions from Heritage Council. So the timeline is, it will be quiet for another few months, I'm afraid. And then come June, we should have our first art exhibition in there. I've got my sights set on a Midsummer Night's Ball on the summer solstice, so the 21st of December.
Oh, right.
There will be a massive party.
Excellent.
And really that will be the kickoff of everything, because at the moment we don't have enough amenities for people to come. We can have 30 people in there at the moment with the toilets that we have. So that all needs to be rectified. And, of course, it actually hasn't got permission to be an assembly hall yet.
So, right.
Yes.
So it's still quite a lot more work to be done.
There's a lot of work to be done, and it's been sitting there for many, many years, and I do hope that people will be patient, but yes, we're going as fast as we possibly can.
No, I'm sure it's going to be marvellous. Let's just come back to the films again for a moment.
Yes.
You talked about setting up a few film societies. Have you got any thoughts about what kinds of films Let's assume that you've satisfied all of the Heritage Council and Oberon Council requirements.
Yes.
And you've got all your toilets set up and all your chairs set up and the screens and the digital projector and all the rest of it, and you are starting to develop a list of films to show. What do you think they might be?
Well, they're not going to be first-run films because we'll never be a Hoyts. But we will certainly be running films that we can actually build an event around. For example, with the Kids Film Society, you know, we'll show the Lego movie, but we'll actually get all the kids to bring their Lego in as well.
Well, that sounds great.
I call it in my head a sort of 4D, you know. So it's, you know, we will show Babette's Feast and actually have dinner in there and just really find the films that mean people can really engage with it for themselves. Creativity is just such an important skill to really develop, and I think that cinema can actually be a really involved experience, and hopefully the Film Society model will help us with that as well.
Lucy, I can't wait.
Oh, really? Good. Can't join the Kids Film Society, but probably join the adult one.
So join them both.
We privately own the Malachi, but we really have a vision to share this precious building with the public, and I'm really enjoying that sort of tension between the two, the private and the public. We would love any offers of help. We've set up a fundraising opportunity on the Australian Cultural Fund, and that's an opportunity for people to support us and cheer us on financially. And just for some patience, that would be great. But you can keep in touch with what we're doing on our website, which is malachigilmorehall.com.au.
Great, great. Lucy, it's been marvellous speaking to you today.
Thank you, Susan.
I've been speaking with Lucy East. Lucy is one of the co-owners of the Malachi Gilmore Hall in Oberon. And we've heard a wonderful outline of the history and some amazing and exciting plans for going forward. Lucy, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you very much.
Now I'd like to introduce Kirsten Mulholland to the program. Kirsten is the co-owner of Mount Vic Flicks out at Mount Victoria in association with Adam Cousins. And they've owned Mount Vic Flicks for just over 5 years. And Kirsten has had a lifelong interest in films. Kirsten, thanks so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you.
Kirsten, what made you decide to buy a cinema?
Well, there's a bit of a story to this one. I used to go to Mount Vic Flicks with a girlfriend of mine when we were 17, 18. And it's this little quaint, quirky cinema up in Mount Victoria. And we used to love it. We used to catch the train up. And we used to always fantasize about running it. We loved it so much. We used to go on about, you know, what we'd do if we ever had it. And it was just always there. It was always a passion. We always visited it. And then I moved to Sydney. I traveled overseas. I had a young family. But it was always there in the back of my mind. I hadn't gone for a few years because we had young children, so we couldn't get out. But somehow it came up in conversation with some friends of mine. And I don't know how it came up, but I just said, oh, my dream's to run Mount Vic Flicks. I've always loved the place, and I would do anything. should it come up, you know, go on sale or whatever to see if we could take it over. And then the next day, one of my friends who was there, she texted me and she said, look, in the Gazette there's an article. So I went and had a look, and there was this article. Because we hadn't gone for the last 3 years because we had little kids, I kind of fell out of the loop. So I wasn't aware that they were retiring and basically closing the doors, and that's what this article was about.
Right.
And there weren't any other prospective buyers to keep the doors open, so they looked like it was going to be shutting up for good around June, I think, July. And there was a bit of a community group that were perhaps looking at taking it over as a community-run organisation because it had been around for about 25 years and they wanted to lose it. So anyway, so I saw that, and Adam always knew, my partner always knew that it was something that I've always wanted to do, but we just kind of never thought. It's one of those things you kind of write off thinking, yeah, I'd love to do it, but it's never going to happen. So I read the article, and I said to Adam one evening, I said, oh, there's a film on tonight, I'm going to go up and have a chat with them. And so that's what I did. And yeah, so it's crazy. I have to pinch myself sometimes. It's crazy how it's come around. And with no experience, like, despite me being slightly obsessed over this cinema, I've not got a background in running a cinema or anything like that. I've always loved films and gone to film festivals when I can, but that was about it. And so, yeah, so it was quite a
quick decision.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Very timely, and that's fantastic. What do you know about the history of Mount Vic Flicks? You said that we'd been going for about 25 years.
Yeah, well, it's 27 years old now, I think. Ron and Diane Bailey, they worked in cinemas before and in radio too, I think. But they were down south, and anyway, they were kind of all of a sudden in their 40s and out of a job. And they just thought, they had some film, they had projectors, they had some equipment, and they just thought, let's see if we can set up our own little independent cinema. So they drove up and down the coast, through the Blue Mountains, looking for a location and an audience where they think they could work. And it came down to two locations. Mount Vic was one, operating out of the public hall there, or some other place, I think, on the coast. Anyway, they approached the Mount Vic Community Association first about, possibly setting up a little, just on a Saturday, Sunday, operating out of the public hall there, and they were very keen, and so they decided to go with that. So for the first, I think, 5 years, they told me, they actually commuted. Like, I think it was a 4-hour round trip, or maybe even 5 hours, up to Mount Vic to set up films for the weekend. And then eventually they made the move there, and it's now, it's...
established.
Yeah, it's established and quite an iconic kind of feature now of the Upper Mountains.
Yeah. It sure is. It sure is. I mean, I have been there myself. I'm sure that the audience is not just from around Mount Victoria, but from the Blue Mountains and out as far as Bathurst, Orange, Oberon.
I mean, we do get some people come up from Wollongong, because quite often we'll screen smaller films that might get a run in Sydney, but not for very long. So, by the time they hear about it, it's not running in Sydney anymore. So we quite often get people who come up for that too.
How do you select the films that you show?
I read up on film festivals. I read all the reviews that come out of all the film festivals, from Sundance, Toronto, Venice, Cannes, all of that. And from that, you kind of glean what films are kind of interesting and quite well made, or or they're covering topics that are really of interest. And so so I kind of do a little short list of that, and then I guess you've got to consider your audience too. So I'll pick films that I think will be of interest to our regulars, and also films of interest to film lovers like myself.
Yes. Do you have a very diverse audience?
It's getting more and more diverse. I think when we started, it was a lot of seniors, a lot of older people who kind of love the Judi Dench films and the Cate Blanchett films and all of that stuff. But I think since over the last 5 years, we have certainly broadened our program, and I think we are seeing a lot more of a diverse audience, a lot younger people too. So, getting back to how I program, we also are quite open to suggestions too. People often, the regulars, flicking us an email asking us if we've heard of such a film, or they've seen a film at a festival but they weren't able to make the festival, and whether we're going to screen it. So we take those on board and try our best to get those films from, particularly if we think there's going to be other people who will be interested in it too.
What kind of films do you like to show?
Personally?
Yes, yeah, that you would like to be watching.
Well, I regularly might choose films that we want to watch, and sometimes we're the only ones in there watching it. But there might be a handful of other people, but I kind of like films that really kind of push the boundaries a bit. I tend to be drawn to films that are a little challenging or darker. At the moment, we're screening The Favourite, which is generated, it's got a lot of buzz because of all the nominations and awards it's picked up. I love his other films too, and they're not everyone's cup of tea, but I certainly am drawn to those kinds of films and some kind of cult films, that are a bit bizarre, very out there, but there's something about them that's quite intriguing and engaging. So I occasionally try and pick those films up, and I know... And I try and encourage, because some of these films are very well made and have had good reviews, but, because Meryl Streep's not in it, no one's coming to see it, It's such a shame, there's so many good films.
I think it's the way that the Hollywood funding works.
Yeah, well, a lot of films won't get up off the ground if they don't have a name, for sure.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And a lot of films, unfortunately, get missed, don't get seen because of that. And it's such a shame, you know.
But you also show a lot of reasonably mainstream films too, don't you?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. I don't mind mainstream films, you know. If they're good, well-made films, I'll show them, you know. I love action films too and B-grade films. You know, I'm not a film snob or anything. You know, if it's well-made or if there's something about it that people want to see, I'll show it, you know. Mm. You know, if it's a really badly made film or... how can I say, if it's not very, I don't know how to say it without sounding like a film snob now, kind of intelligently made, you know, if it's really kind of dumb, you know, I'm not going to bother with it, unless if it's so dumb it's funny, then I might look at it.
Yeah. So let's talk about the cinema itself. So this is quite an old building, isn't it?
Yeah, it was built in 1934.
Well, is that when it was a public hall?
Yeah, it was built as a public hall, but it was used as a cinema as well. However, the projection box that we have now, that we operate out of now, wasn't originally there, but it was shortly afterwards. But it was primarily used as a dance hall. I did show pictures during the 50s. It's very sketchy, the history that we know of the cinema. There weren't many records of it. So what we know of is from the minutes of the community association that date quite a fair way back. We did know it operated as a picture theatre in the 50s, but then I think with television...
Yeah, TV and
of television, I think
digital movies, etc. made a big difference. Well, one of the things, and as I've mentioned before, I've been to your cinema because I'm also a film lover, and I think I've been to all of the local, cinemas. You do something that I haven't seen happen anywhere else, and that is that people can, prior to the movie, people can buy a cup of tea or coffee or a scone or a cup of soup.
Yeah.
That's a terrific idea.
It is, yeah, and it's really kind of taken off. It's got a life of its own now. When they always served cups of tea, Ron and Diane always had cups of tea and Choc Tops, the usual kind of snack bar fare.
Yeah.
But when we were talking, you know, in those beginning stages of taking over the business, you know, the cafe up the row was going under renovations, and Diane said, oh, we've just started, you know, she had a friend who used to bake, we've just started kind of every now and then if we have the time... baking them or putting on a soup because there was just nowhere to eat in town.
Mm.
And she said, so you might want to look into doing that. And I thought, all right, because the first thing I wanted to do was just to continue on what Ron and Diane had been done because it's been so loved. I didn't want to kind of change anything. You know?
Yeah.
I thought, well, if that's what you did, I'll do that too. So I started making soups and slice and doing them more regularly. I think Ron and Diane just had it when they, you know, would just provide it when they had the moment to do it, you know, to make that sort of stuff. And so I just started doing it, but having it regularly and it just kind of took off.
Yeah.
So now everyone expects that there's scones or slice and biscuits there and soup in the cooler months of the year because, I mean, it's still, there's nothing much open still in the evenings, especially during the weeknights. And
yeah.
And people love it. People love it. It's become part of the charm now, you know.
It is. Charm is a very good word to use. It's you don't have to resile away from that. It's an extremely charming little space, and it is a bit quirky.
Mm.
It's interesting to see so many different kinds of movies being shown there.
Yeah. As I said, we try and keep the programming as appealing to as many people as we can in the mountains because there is, you know, we're pretty mixed up here. There's a lot of community groups up here that are interested in, you know, a lot of the documentaries we show too. And we quite often show... Tonight we've got a locally made doco called Give a Dam about the raising of the Warragamba Dam.
Mm.
So we try and sort of keep things local too, wherever we can.
Kirsten, what about the future? Are you going to keep with the pattern that you've established? Are you thinking of doing something a little bit different? What are you thinking? What are your thoughts about the future of Mount Vic Flicks?
Yeah, well, we do have some ideas. But with the young family and stuff, we're sort of just flat out just doing what we're doing at the moment.
Mm.
You know, I do have some plans on, you know, perhaps having a film club, starting a film club perhaps, doing some more kind of special event screenings. I'd love to get involved, pick up some more festivals, like the French Film Festival.
Oh, yeah.
Down in Sydney, I'd love to be able to, you know, maybe... do more of that, and I think we will eventually, but we're just taking it easy because it's been such a a huge learning curve, you know, for us and with young kids. We just don't want to take on too much too soon. But,
yeah, that makes sense.
Things that we'd like to do. And even with the actual, on the technical side of things, I mean, we've done a lot too. You know, we've converted to digital, we've got new sound, and we're still working on that. Like, we're still slowly putting up some sound panels in the cinema to improve the quality of the sound. So we're chipping away at things.
And do you make buckets of money out of this endeavour?
No. No. No, but we love what we do. We absolutely love what we do. And it is paying for itself, so that's a good thing. But
it was
definitely, and we knew when we made the decision to take it on, it was always a lifestyle choice. It was never about making loads of money, you know. Mm. As long as it pays for itself and we can make a living from it, you know, we're happy with that. We really are.
Well, that sounds marvellous. Well, all power to you, Kirsten. I hope you are able to continue Mount Vic Flicks. It would be a terrible loss if you decided not to keep going with it.
Yeah.
We've been listening to Kirsten Mulholland. Kirsten and her partner Adam have had Mount Vic Flicks for over 5 years, and as we've just heard, a huge learning curve, and obviously still great sounds of enthusiasm in your voice, Kirsten. Kirsten, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thanks. Thank you.
Now, I'd like to welcome Tad to our program. Tad, for all of you regular 2MCE listeners, will know that he's one of the presenters of Cult Fiction, and he also does Saturday Night Jukebox. And for a lifetime, Tad has loved old movies.
Have I ever? Yeah. Ever since I was a kid, watching old movies on TV was the thing. On a Saturday or Sunday, it was an embarrassment of riches watching all of the Murren Park Kettle movies, all of the old Red Skelton movies, Danny Kaye, back when I was much younger, Jerry Lewis. Then I turned 9 and realised it wasn't funny. And also the B-Western.
Before TV, going to the movies was the highlight of the week, especially for kids who would go to the Saturday afternoon movies and they'd see a whole lot of old cowboy movies. What were they all about, Tad?
Well, the cowboy movies, the B-Westerns as they were in the 40s and 50s, that was a whole industry in itself, because not only was there Hopalong Cassidy, there was Charles Starrett as the Durango Kid, and his sidekicks were either Dub Taylor, who was otherwise nicknamed Cannonball, or Smiley Burnett, who a lot of people might remember as the engineer in the TV show Petticoat Junction. But it didn't stop there, because you also had your Roy Rogers and Dale Evans. And in fact, there's an old Bob Hope movie, The Son of Paleface, the sequel to The Paleface, where the wildcards that were brought in were Roy Rogers and Trigger. And there's a scene in that where there's Bob Hope in bed with Trigger, and Trigger keeps stealing the covers off Bob Hope using his teeth. And the punchline to that scene is Bob Hope stealing the covers off Trigger using his teeth. So there was a lot of crossover in all of these things. But the B-Westerns, the Cisco Kid, Gene Autry, but they weren't just on the big screen. They also were so popular, they had their own comic books. The Durango Kid had his own comic. Of course, Hopalong Cassidy, Roy Rogers, Dale Evans had her own comic. They even had a comic about Trigger. But Smiley Burnett, who was the Durango Kid's sidekick, he had a comic as well. So that was massive in those times. And again, this is all pre-TV. Now, I should point out that even though Charles Starrett did 65 Durango Kid movies, he was pipped at the post for the most times an actor played a character in anything by William Boyd, who played Hopalong Cassidy. And he very smartly, when he finished doing the Hopalong Cassidy movies, he bought the rights to all of them. And then he had them rebadged for TV. So when he could see their time was coming, he made a squillion off it, because he had the rights and he was able to introduce a whole new audience. I touched on very briefly Red Skelton. Sadly, in recent years, Red Skelton declared before he died that when he died, he wanted all of his movies destroyed. And I thought that was unfortunate. But then I understood his frustration, because no one was screening his movies again. A lot of people still remember Danny Kaye, but Red Skelton was right up there as another another court jester of Hollywood. So you wouldn't have seen the two of them in a movie together because they literally, each of them jockeying for similar roles, but no one ever thought to put the two of them together. But the stuff he did the Whistling movies, Whistling in the Dark, Whistling in Dixie, Whistling in Brooklyn. The first one, Whistling in the Dark, the villain in that was Conrad Veidt, who was in a movie called The Man Who Laughed, which was the inspiration for the character The Joker in Batman. The Whistling in Brooklyn movie, the guest stars in that were the Brooklyn Dodgers, the baseball team.
They had a whole lot of extras in that.
Oh, yeah. And they would have had the extras in that would have given the illusion of a full stadium. Whether they just had enough extras in there to fill the screen for this shot, and then they probably moved them all over to another part to give the illusion.
Were they actual fans, do you think?
Oh, they probably were. People would have just teamed in just to do it for nothing.
Yeah.
Because baseball was a huge thing back then, just as much as all these screen stars. I mean, these screen stars were basically gods to them. You know, Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis or Abbott and Costello, people just idolised them.
And the same thing with the romance and dance movies, like Fred Astaire and...
Yeah.
I mean, everybody remembers...
Ginger Rogers. Yeah, with Fred Astaire.
Ginger Rogers, who always wore these absolutely glorious satin dresses, and my gosh, the two of them together were always just amazing.
Well, see, it comes back down to why people go to these things in the first place. Escapism. Yeah. We escape out of our lives into another world where we can enjoy whatever. Yeah, we had the Oscars, and the fact of the matter is I couldn't be happier by the fact that Green Book took out Best Picture. And for me, that was the best picture. I enjoyed it so much, I watched it again. And that's a movie I will watch again and again and again because it's a great story and a true story too. And, you know, whether these are older movies or recent movies or whatever, the same rules apply. We do escape into these worlds for just a brief moment to take our minds off our own worries.
And with these old movies, so we're talking about the 30s and 40s, what do you think were the social reasons why people went to the movies? And how is it different to the way that we go to the movies now?
Well, I think these days it's not so much that we go to the movies for the social aspect. I mean, we go to the movies because we want to see the pictures. Whereas back then it was a big social thing. I mean, this takes us right back to the early days of the silent pictures that were depicted in the movie The Picture Show Man with John Millian, Johnny Ewart, Rod Taylor and Harold Hopkins. Because people would go along on a Saturday night, The Picture Show Man would be in town, it was a big thing. These days, we've got so many other distractions. We've got social media. I don't know that we see too many people lift their heads from their phones these days. But the fact of the matter is, it's a whole new world. And thankfully, there are some throwbacks that still exist.
So when people went to the movies, they went there not just to watch the film, did they?
No, it was in the 30s and 40s, and particularly in the 40s, as I recall, they also had the serials, so that it was like the 15-part serials that would be the prequel to the movie. So it might have been something like Captain America or Superman or Spy Shadow or Fu Manchu or whatever, and want to see the next chapter, and it would be along with a movie. So there was that come back for more sort of thing. And at the same time, they were also hooking into B-Westerns or these romantic comedies and things like that that there were at the time. Or even something as cracking as a Marx Brothers movie, because those things were, you know, really sold seats. And even if a person had seen something before, you know, if they wanted to get the next chapter of the serial and they happened to be throwing an old movie on as well, well, why not? And again, this was how they found their entertainment. Kids would save up their pocket money just so they could go to the movies on the weekend and catch the latest episode of the serial. And at least the parents knew they were keeping out of trouble.
Yes. And with some of the adult movies, I mean, I can remember my mother telling me about going to the movies. And they would sing. There'd be a song during the movie or in between. And everybody would sing and they'd all have hand gestures as part of it.
Well, see, all that started in the silent era, as depicted in The Picture Show Man, because you'd have the projectionist had put the silent movie on, the pianist would be playing the music that accompanied the scene because there was no sound, and if the movie broke down for whatever reason, the pianist would say, okay, well, we're getting that sorted out, let's have a sing-along. And that's really where all that started. And all you have to do is get hold of the movie The Picture Show Man, and you'll see what I mean, because that movie from 1977 really captured an era, and it was a true story because it was written by the son from Pym's Pictures on Tour. The character played by Harold Hopkins, being the son, was the person who wrote the book that was what they got the idea for the movie from. The Picture Show Man would do the Riverlands, tour around and compete with one another, and pretty much on for young and old. If people just want to get an idea of where it all started, that movie will give you an inkling into how it all came about.
Let's have a look at another era, a more recent era, and that's the era of the drive-in movies.
The drive-in movies. I remember them. One time we went to Cremorne and one of my friends decided, as part of the tradition of going to the drive-in movies, was to be smuggled in the boot of the car. Now, it's not because he didn't have the money, not that we couldn't afford to have him there. It's just that that was the thrill of doing that, because people used to do that all the time.
Yeah.
And as I recall, one of the movies that we saw
was
that
he caught?
Time... No, it wasn't caught. No, No, we got away with it. But the movie that was screened at the time was Private Benjamin. But, you know, Cremorne, Bass Hill, so many places, and all of them died off one after another. The year I was in Alice Springs, we had the drive-in theatre in Alice Springs close and reopen and close and reopen, and that was within that year. And that was a landmark year, because that was the year of movies like Footloose and Ghostbusters and you name it. But again, an era that has come and gone. And it's a shame, because I would have thought that there'd still be mileage in doing something as retro as a drive-in.
Yeah, but I think one of the things that's overtaken it now is outdoor cinema.
Well, that's right, yeah.
Mm.
Oh, outdoor cinema's a lot of fun. I think I'd just like to see maybe someone set up a screen in the Common in Oberon and, you know, be able to watch a movie at night. The only problem is it'd be too damn cold.
Yeah. You know, I was talking to somebody the other day who is also a movie buff, and I asked him the question, well, how did you start to enjoy movies? And he told me a terrific story. He said that when he was 4 or 5 years old, it was before he started going to school, his parents decided to go to Star Wars movie on at the local drive-in cinema, and they thought that he'd just fall asleep in the back seat. Oh, no way. He stayed awake until 11 o'clock that night, transfixed by Star Wars, and it was the start of a lifelong obsession with watching movies. How did that happen to you, Ted?
Well, for me, I recall my parents used to take me into town of a night, and we would see a lot of the Disney movies that were screening at the time. I saw movies like Mary Poppins the first time, also My Fair Lady, The Three Lives of Thomasina, That Darn Cat, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. A lot of these movies I got to see the first time around, and that was really one of the things that hooked me into it. And to be going to the pictures with both my mum and my dad was a really big thing. So that was one of the things that hooked me, that and TV. TV in the 60s was a real smorgasbord for a kid. I had heroes like the Durango Kid, the Lone Ranger, Astro Boy, and of course the Adventures of Superman, and catching Batman, the Adam West Batman, the first time around. And what really hooked me into music was watching the Beatles cartoon show and the Monkees TV show first time around.
Yep.
So these things, you know, they stay in your memory.
Well, they've captured
memory.
Your imagination, haven't they?
Well, they did, and they still do to today. I mean, sure, later on I became, I guess, a little more sophisticated in all of this, but back then it was all raw. It was first time around, and that's what all these things are. They're time capsules. They're literally something from back then which has survived till now. And we're keeping those memories and those actors alive. They are long gone.
Now, you're going to cover some of this ground in one of your upcoming programs, aren't you?
Yeah, I want to do it. The topic is Gone But Not Forgotten. I know I've done some of these topics we've done before, but whenever we do a topic like this, we only really scratch the surface. And it's just nice to be able to remind people about the beauty of some of these older pictures. Some people might go, oh, if it's in black and white, it's no good. I challenge people to watch Here Comes Mr. Jordan and then watch the remake, which was Heaven Can Wait. Now, Here Comes Mr. Jordan had Robert Montgomery, Claude Rains and Everett Edward Horton. That was a classic. Heaven Can Wait had Warren Beatty, Julie Christie, Diane Cannon, Charles Grodin and Buck Henry, who was one half of Get Smart. And let me tell you, the original Here Comes Mr. Jordan is fantastic. But Heaven Can Wait is so flat, dull and boring, despite its all-star cast. So this black and white movie knocks it out of the park. I challenge anyone to watch the two of them back to back and challenge me on that.
Ted, it's been fantastic talking to you today. Thanks heaps for joining me. I'm Susan Lacey, and thank you very much for joining me today. Join me again next time. Bye for now.